Space with Worldbots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 40th episode of Robots. Today's show is a special episode on space robots. We'll start by speaking with Julie Townsend from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and her work with NASA's Mars rovers and the Lunar Athlete robot.
We then speak with Sebastian Gauch from the SAM Lab in Neuchâtel, Switzerland, who tells us about the atomic force microscope that he designed that was actually sent to Mars aboard the Phoenix lander in spring of 2008.
And finally, we want to know what you think about the Robots podcast so that we can make our show, website, and forum even better. Therefore, we've set up a short survey at www.robotspodcast.com/survey. With nearly 100,000 downloads since our launch, it's now our turn to listen to you. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news from Christine.
Thanks, Adam. Last week, the Biennial International Robot Exposition, IREX, organized by the Japan Robot Association, took place in Tokyo, Japan, featuring work from more than 100 robot companies and research institutions. Among the robots shown were the latest version of the ping-pong-playing humanoid Topio by Vietnamese robotics company Tosi, a team of Motoman industrial robots wielding laser swords, as well as robotic roller skates, a kind of technological crossover between children's stilts and a Segway, developed by Japan's National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology, AIST. Researchers at the University of Auckland and Korea's Electronics and Telecommunication Research Institute have introduced a robot as the latest member of a New Zealand retirement home. The humanoid named Charlie is built by South Korean company Yujin and takes residents' vital signs, delivers personalized medication reminders, and helps make calls for assistance in case of accidents. Charlie is part of the three-year HealthBots project aimed at exploring seniors' attitudes towards robots. The IEEE, in cooperation with California-based company Willow Garage, has announced the third edition of its Mobile Manipulation Challenge. Unlike its two previous editions, which only had free demonstrations, this third edition will also feature competition in two standardized tasks: cleaning up a room that has been used as a toddler's playground, and clearing a dining room table, placing all the dishes in a dishwasher tray. The challenge will be held in May 2010 in conjunction with the IEEE International Conference on Robotics and Automation in Anchorage, Alaska. For more information on the robots demonstrated at Japan's IREX, retiree robot Charlie, and the Mobile Manipulation Challenge, visit the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Julie Townsend is a robotics software engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology, which works for NASA on a whole range of space missions. As an insider in what I think is a dream job, she'll be telling us all about the Mars exploration rovers she helped develop, test, and finally pilot. She is now a rover planner, creating command sequences to drive the rovers and move their robotic arms on Mars. In addition, she is also working on the Athlete robot, which will be used as part of the Human Lunar Return campaign to help load, transport, manipulate, and deposit payloads to any desired sites of interest.
Hi, Julie. Welcome to Robots.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
My name is Julie Townsend. I'm a robotics engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And I work on Mars missions, and I work on prototype robots for future missions.
What is the Jet Propulsion Laboratory?
Jet Propulsion Laboratory is a part of the California Institute of Technology University, and it is contracted to NASA to do NASA work. So we are a federally funded R&D center that does work almost exclusively for NASA.
Working for the NASA is a dream for most roboticists. How do you actually get to the point where you work for the NASA?
Well, it takes a lot of hard work and a little bit of luck, like many of these kinds of jobs. It really helps to come in through a summer program or be recommended by someone who has personal contacts at the location. Personally, I was recommended here by some of my professors in graduate school, and they were the ones who set up for me to come down here for an interview.
Did you personally dream of working for the NASA?
I always was very interested in space from a very young age, and I was always interested in robotics. But I actually had never even heard of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory until I was in college. So it's not like it was a lifelong dream of mine to work here particularly, but in college I became very interested in planetary robotic missions because I was a student intern at the Marshall Space Flight Center when the Pathfinder mission landed on Mars. And that was the first rover that carried the Sojourner rover, which was the first rover on Mars. And I thought that was just about the coolest thing I'd ever seen, although at that time I would never have dreamed that I'd be working on the very next mission.
Generally, why are robots interesting for space missions?
Robots are really interesting for space missions because they can take us to places where we can't yet send humans. And although they're not quite as capable as, say, a human geologist, the Mars exploration rovers can still send us back that geologic information over a long period of time. They've sent us back lots of information that's helped us understand the planet much better.
You started your work at the JPL by working on the Mars exploration rovers. What was the goal of this mission?
The goal of the Mars exploration rover mission, scientifically, was to determine if there was ever a water environment on Mars. So the reason that's important is because everywhere on Earth where there's a good water source, and a good energy source, we find some kind of life that's evolved to live in that environment. And so one of the clues to determining whether Mars was ever capable of sustaining life or possibly developing life would be if it had aqueous environments with water in them. So we currently, on the surface of Mars, it appears to be very dry. I mean, we can see past activity of water, things that look like channels that were carved by water, but we don't actually see any water on the surface of Mars. And so what the Mars exploration rovers were equipped to do is to study the rocks in environments on Mars and determine if those rocks were formed in a water environment, which would give us proof that at one point there had been water in that area, although there isn't now.
So you started speaking about the rovers. Can you present them more in detail to us, like what are the sensors, actuators, etc.?
Sure. The Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, landed on Mars in January of 2004. And there are two identical rovers. They went to opposite sides of the planet, and they are equipped to study geology. So our principal investigator, Steve Squires, calls them the robotic geologists. And they carry a little geologist tool set with them. So they have a camera mast, which stands at about the eye level of a human. I'm about 5'8", and I'm about eye level with the rover. And that has sets of stereo cameras that we can use to see the terrain around the rover in three dimensions, including one pair that's a science set of cameras which can capture color images that we use to help us determine what types of rocks we're looking at. We also have a spectrometer that looks out of that PanCam mast called the Mini-TESS, the Mini Thermal Emission Spectrometer. And that can also analyze rocks from a distance to determine what they're made out of. We use those tools to figure out which rocks we want to drive up to and do a more in-depth study of, because it's a several-day process on Mars to do a study of a rock with our robotic arm instruments. And on the robotic arm, we have a rock abrasion tool, which is a tool that can scrape away several millimeters, up to about a centimeter, of the surface material of a rock, so that we can get through the weathering and the dust that's on top of the rock from having sat on the surface of Mars for millions of years usually, and get into the inside of the rock and see what that rock was really made of when it was formed. So we use the RAT to get through the weathering surface of the rock, and there are three other instruments on the robotic arm. These are the microscopic imager, which is, as it sounds, a camera that takes images at a very high resolution, so it's like looking at the rock through a microscope. It's kind of similar to what a geologist would use as a hand lens that they would use to look at the formation of the rock, the structural formation of the rock in detail to determine, you know, how it's, you know, kind of what its makeup is and how it was potentially formed. And then we have two spectrometers on the end of the arm that tell us what kind of minerals are in the rock.
And to what extent are these rovers autonomous? Like, what can they decide to do and what is teleoperated?
Well, the robots are not directly teleoperated in the way that we usually use that term. So teleoperated usually indicates that you actually have somebody with a joystick or some other controller who's controlling the rover live. Because Mars is so far away, it takes, you know, up to maybe about 45 minutes for a round-trip signal to get to Mars and back to us. So it's not very effective to directly teleoperate them. So the way that we operate the rovers is that we send them up a series of commands each Martian morning, and then after they've completed those commands in the afternoon, they have a communications pass with us where they send us back pictures and data about the scientific exploration that they've done that day, and we use that data and those images to plan our next day's activities. So we do a lot of the planning in simulation at JPL using 3D maps of the surface that we have made from the images that the rover has sent back. But it does have some autonomous capabilities. For example, we can tell it when driving, it has several different autonomous capabilities it can use. It can do autonomous hazard avoidance, so it can use the cameras on the rover to look for rocks as it drives, so that if we're driving it through an area we couldn't see clearly in the images that the rover sent back, it can keep itself safe. It can also go a step beyond that and use its information to plan a new path that gets it to the desired goal, avoiding those obstacles. And we also have it also has the capability to use visual odometry, comparing images each step of the drive as it takes them, to account for any slip, so that we can more accurately get to targets. It also has some science autonomy. Over the past couple of years, we've actually sent new software up to the rovers, and one of those new software loads included functionality to help us look for things that happen rarely on the surface of Mars. So some of the things we like to see on the surface of Mars in the scientists' study are dust devils and clouds. And it's hard to guess ahead of time when a cloud will be in the sky or when a dust devil will be careening past the rover to plan when you need to take that picture, when that dust devil is going to be there. The dust devil doesn't send us a schedule that says, I'm going to be there at 2 o'clock on SALT 2045, so you might want to take a picture then. So the way that we study them at the very beginning of the mission was we would just say, okay, well, we're going to spend an hour taking pictures, and then we'll send them down and see if there are any dust devils in them. Now we have some autonomy on the vehicle that can actually look at those pictures before they're sent down to Earth and determine if there is a dust devil in the picture or not. And that way we don't use our limited radio bandwidth sending pictures down to Earth that don't have the data we're looking for in them.
You actually worked on this mission. What parts did you get to touch on?
Well, actually, I'm still working on this mission. I work on two different missions. I work on the Athlete, which we'll talk about a little later, and I work on the Mars Exploration Rovers, and I do both of those about half of my time. The Mars Exploration Rovers I've worked on since 2001, so I've been through a lot of different phases of this mission, from development through integration and testing of the flight vehicles, and I was on the team that that monitored the launch of the rovers and did all of the control and commanding as they traveled from Earth to Mars. I was in the room when we landed them, and I've been operating them on the surface almost continuously since they landed. I've held several different positions on the rovers.
So what is different when developing technologies for a Mars rover or for a robot on Earth, for example?
Well, the biggest difference between developing a Mars rover versus a rover that's going to be used on Earth is that you cannot access the Mars rover. Once you've launched it, it's gone, and so it works as well as it does. You know, if it has a problem, you're going to have to work around that problem. You're not going to be able to make a repair. Whereas if you're using a rover on Earth, if something goes wrong, you can fix it and move on. So that means that when we're planning these Mars missions, we're always being very careful about how the rover is designed and that it's assembled exactly correctly and that no damage is done to the rover during assembly or during test, because we want to make sure that we haven't introduced any failures that are going to happen out there in space that we won't be able to fix later.
I'm wondering, how do you test a Mars robot?
We test them in a variety of different ways. So the software that runs the rovers is tested very thoroughly through a variety of simulations on computers, through test beds where we have similar hardware, sometimes exactly the same hardware, sometimes even the spare flight hardware that we use on the rovers, and we then just try to exercise all of that on the ground to make sure it works exactly as we expect it to. So we develop thousands upon thousands of pages of test procedures that we are going to use to exercise the rover's code. For the hardware, it goes through life testing. We build extra versions of it so that we can send some through exhaustive testing without damaging the ones that are actually going to go to Mars. And it's tested in a wide variety of different ways. Basically, we perform on it every test we can A, think of, and B, have time and money to do to ensure that we're certain that the rover that we're sending up is going to work.
You mentioned before that you're still working on this mission, and Spirit is currently stuck in a sand ditch, basically. Are you working on this, actually?
I have been. So I'm currently a rover driver for the rovers, which means that I am responsible for creating command sequences that move the rover from place to place and deploy the instrument deployment device, which is what we call the robotic arm, onto targets of interest to take scientific measurements. So basically, anytime the rover moves or moves its arm, a rover planner, a rover driver is involved in that activity. So that's my role on the mission now. And over the past few weeks, I've mostly been commanding the Opportunity rover, but over last summer, when we were first starting the tests in our test bed to examine how we were going to get Spirit out to try to make a plan for extricating Spirit, I was very active in that test bed testing because I have a lot of experience with the test beds from the integration and test work that I did earlier in the mission. I expect to be going back onto the Spirit mission in the next couple of months to help out with the extraction process. We just this week have started sending commands to Spirit to start driving out of the area she's been stuck in for the last 6 months.
So the robot is a girl.
Oh, the robots are all girls.
Okay, excellent.
Like ships. They're spaceships. All ships are considered to be female, and so we generally consider spaceships like space rovers to also be female.
Okay, excellent. With all this testing and all this information, the 3D imaging, etc., it gives us an impression that you have a perfect image of your environment. Does controlling the robot actually do things you don't expect in the end?
Well, things we don't expect happen pretty frequently. I mean, we've gotten over the 6 years that the rovers have been on Mars. I mean, they'll celebrate their six-year anniversary on Mars this January. We've become very familiar with the environment on Mars, and we know what we expect to happen. But anytime we go into a new environment, we visit a new crater, or we enter a new area where maybe the sand dunes have slightly different characteristics, we are always learning about how the rover is going to interact with that environment. That's what makes driving a rover so much different than operating an orbiting satellite. You know, the orbiting satellite has a very predictable environment that it's operating in. The environment that the rover operates in is what we call non-deterministic. I mean, that means that the rover's in a different spot every day. The interaction of the wheels with the soil is going to be a little bit different every day. And so while we know what to expect in some conditions, sometimes things surprise us. Take, for example, Spirit's current situation. They were driving Spirit through this area that they believed to be safe. The images showed terrain that looked much like any terrain around in the area we'd been driving in, you know, red, peppered with little rocky pebbles. But that was a very thin crust over some very soft material. And so what happened was as the rover drove into that area, the five wheels that were driving the vehicle, because Spirit has one broken wheel at this point, the five wheels that were driving the vehicle broke through that crust and started to sink into that soft, sandy material. So that's an example of the surprises that happen to us on Mars every once in a while, because we do have imperfect knowledge of what's there on the surface. We use the instruments that we have there in the best ways that we can to understand the terrain around us, but I mean, they are just pictures. We're not there, and we can't actually feel the terrain. We can't, like, go walk on it and make sure it's firm enough for the rover. We have to be able to look at it from a distance and try to make an educated guess that it's going to be whether or not it's going to be safe.
So the rovers are still up there, but could you already summarize some of the results which came out of this mission?
The Mars rover mission has been very successful. Both of the rovers have discovered evidence of water on the surface of Mars. The Opportunity rover, in particular, was very fortunate to land in Eagle Crater, which was a really small crater that the rovers landed in airbags, and the Opportunity lander just rolled into this tiny little 20-meter crater, and just about 7 meters away from the lander was an outcrop of rock. And they used studying that outcrop of rock, they determined that those rocks had been formed in like a shallow aqueous environment with water lapping over sediment that caused those sedimentary rocks to be formed. And not only that, but that over time, even after those sedimentary rocks had been formed, water had soaked them and dissolved some minerals inside them and deposited other minerals, causing hematite concretions to be built up inside the sedimentary rocks, which we saw when we first landed as what we called blueberries on the surface, because they were little tiny rocks about the size of a blueberry in a muffin that that had more of a blue hue than the reddish soil that is covering most of Mars. So that's an example of a really successful scientific exploration at the Opportunity site. And Opportunity has continued to make similar discoveries as she travels from one crater to the next. So she's traveled from Little Eagle Crater to larger and larger craters, and she's on her way to the largest crater yet, even as we speak. She's on a very long traverse. But in each place that we stop, we are able to study more of the rock layers, the sedimentary rock layers, and understand more of how they were laid down. And it gives us even more evidence that there were shallow lakes of a sort at the Opportunity landing site. Now, the Spirit site was a little bit harder for us to find evidence of water in. The area where Spirit landed was covered mostly with basaltic rock and the type of sand that you would expect to be laid down from a lava flow. So in order to actually find sedimentary rock, Spirit had to drive to some hills that were higher than that lava flow had been to get a look at some of the older rocks in the area. And just in the past couple of years, after Spirit lost the use of her right front wheel, we discovered that there was a very light silica material that dragging right front wheel was digging up. And the scientists saw the glint of it in some of our imagery and went back to study it. And it's a silica material, I think, similar to what is seen near hydrothermal vents on Earth. And so they believe that that is also evidence that there was water at or near the surface of the Gusev crater area as well.
Now let's look at what will probably be one of the next successes at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the Athlete robot, which you're also working on. Can you present this robot to us?
Yes, the Athlete robot. Athlete stands for the All-Terrain, Hex-Limbed, Extraterrestrial Explorer, and is being developed to support astronaut missions on the moon. Athlete is a very kind of modular utility robot. It has six legs, and each of those legs is a fully articulated robotic arm that can be extended to up to about 13 feet long. And on the end of each of those legs is a wheel. Now, the Athlete vehicle has six legs, and so it looks kind of like it's got a hexagonal base. And so it looks kind of like a spider that can drive around the moon or walk. And its primary purpose, what will make it the most useful for the astronaut missions, is offloading cargo from the Altair cargo lander that's being designed at Johnson Space Center. So the lander is designed to carry several tons of cargo down to the surface of the moon, but because it carries so much cargo, it has to also carry a lot of propellant to land that cargo safely on the moon. The cargo deck sits atop the propellant tanks, which means that in some of the current designs, it's been as high as 6 or 7 meters off the ground. So that's a long way for astronauts to be able to haul down cargo of several tons. So Athlete is a robot that can actually reach the ground from the top of the Altair lander and walk that cargo off and then transport it across the surface of the moon to where it's going to be used for the astronaut mission.
Why did you actually go for a leg wheel locomotion modality?
Well, primarily because it allows us to extend the wheels down to the ground from the top of the lander. But it gives us a lot of other advantages on the moon. Because it's a legged vehicle, it can travel over terrain that would be too difficult for a vehicle with only wheels. But then because it has wheels on the end of each leg, it can travel more quickly than a purely legged vehicle when the terrain is easy, when it's mostly just rolling sand dunes.
I know you already tested this robot. Are there things you have had to redesign after the testing, like anecdotes?
Well, the Athlete robot is a prototype project right now, which means it's worked on by a very small team, and we're just quickly assembling we assemble the concept out of commercially available parts so that we can prove that the concept is a good one. So we're currently on our second generation Athlete. Our first generation Athlete was built in 2005, and of course, with any complex machine that you build for the first time, when you first start testing it out, you quickly realize that there are changes that you want to make it even better. And so we've made a lot of those changes in our second-generation vehicle. Now, the second-generation vehicle is bigger than the first generation. It's a full half-scale vehicle. It stands up to about 13 feet tall, and we've actually done some demonstrations that in the field of it walking off, carrying a mock-up habitat off of a half-scale lander that stands about 10 and a half feet tall. Some of the other changes that we made, one of the difficulties that we had with the first-generation Athlete was we wanted it to carry cargo around and be able to deploy that cargo to the surface, but we had some difficulty determining how we were going to get cargo on and off the deck of the robot. So the second-generation Athlete actually splits into two independent three-legged vehicles. And the way that that works is that each three-legged robot can then dock to the side of a cargo pallet to create a six-legged Athlete. And then when it wants to set the cargo down, it can drop the cargo onto the ground and undock the two three-legged robots, and they can drive away on their own. So that way, a single pair of Athletes can move several pieces of cargo around.
When do you see the Athlete robot being deployed in reality?
The Athlete robot is being developed to support the astronauts' return to the moon. So its deployment is tied to lunar missions. So Athletes at different scales can be envisioned using to mobilize precursor robotic missions to the moon. At full scale, they'll probably arrive around the time of that astronauts are sent back to the moon to transport cargo to support the astronauts' presence there. So we're probably looking at anywhere from a few years to 10 or 12 years before an Athlete is deployed to the moon, depending on what the lunar schedule ends up being.
And a final general question, what type of robot would you like to see in space?
What type of robot do I like to see in space?
Or futuristic idea of a robot in space.
My futuristic idea, well, I would really like to see the Athlete concept fly in space. It would allow us to access more different kinds of terrain on planetary surfaces than is possible with our standard wheeled robots. But as for futuristic ideas, the interesting thing about robots is that they're designed to do the particular task that is needed. And so the futuristic ideas and the technology developments that we make on these space robots are generally to serve a particular purpose. So the futuristic robots will do whatever it is we decide that we need them to do. And so the more difficult the task that we're trying to do out there in space or on a planetary surface, the more innovative our robots will become to accomplish those tasks.
Thanks, Julie, for being here with us on Robots.
Of course, it was my pleasure.
So Sebastian Gauch recently completed his PhD at the Institute of Microtechnology in Neuchâtel, Switzerland, the goal of which was to design a miniature atomic force microscope destined to analyze dust particles on the Martian surface. He'll be telling us about the difficulties in creating sensors for space, as well as the impressive results they achieved with their sensor that was used on the Phoenix Lander mission in 2008.
Hi, Sebastian. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hello.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself to our listeners?
Okay, I'm from Neuchâtel here in Switzerland, and I'm working in a microtechnology group from Professor De Roy, and I'm actually part of the École Polytechnique Fédérale of Lausanne, so EPFL. And what we do as a specialty is microfabrication of very small actuators and sensors out of silicon.
We're here today to talk about the AFM microscope that you designed for the Mars Phoenix lander. Can you tell us quickly, just to get started, about the Phoenix mission in general for those who haven't been following the news too much? What's it about? What was the purpose of the mission? And what did you hope to find out with it?
So the primary goal of this lander, which was sent to Mars last summer, or landed on Mars last summer, is to follow the water. That means we are landing very close to the polar caps, and we would like to analyze the icy water that was inferred by orbiting instruments around Mars. And we would like to land in this region and to analyze the soil and the ice of that region. So the name Phoenix is actually quite evoking, because it's a lander that has been canceled in 2001 and was rescheduled then for 2008. And that's why it's called Phoenix, due to the Greek mythology bird which rises from its ashes every time again. And so the payloads that are on this mission are actually all designed for an earlier mission and were rescheduled for this new mission of 2008.
Tell us a little bit about the payloads then. What do you hope to discover other than Eureka, we found water? Obviously, you're looking for a little bit more than that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, the payload we're part of is called MECA, and there is a big microscopy station in there, which has an optical microscope to look at particles down to 10 micrometers in size. And then we have our atomic force microscope, who analyzes small dust particles, even smaller than that. And the other payloads of Phoenix are basically all designed to infer the composition of the soil and the ice. So there is spectroscopy measurements, some sort of electrochemistry analysis done with the soil. It's mixed with water and heated up, and they analyze the emitting gases out of that to see if there are any organic compounds. And that's basically the big goals of Phoenix, is to look at composition, size of the soil of Mars.
And why is this interesting exactly? Why do we care what the soil is made of?
It's all about looking at the history of the planet and how it has evolved in the last hundred thousands of millions of years, and to know more about the soil in its actual state gives us some hints on how it has evolved, how it has been submitted to erosion, to weathering, any type of alternating the soil.
Other than the history, can this have some sort of use for future Mars missions, manned missions in particular?
That was the primary goal of MECA, and the 2001 mission was to infer those hazards for human exploration. This goal has slightly changed, in meaning that we still analyze the soil, we still analyze by microscopy all these components, but it's less designed now to prepare for human missions. But the results coming from this may certainly also prepare a future human mission.
Maybe let's talk about the details of your project then. You were part of the atomic force microscope that was sent as part of Phoenix. Can you quickly tell us what an atomic force microscope is?
Okay. So atomic force microscopy uses a very sharp tip that is scanned over a surface in a raster-like manner, so line by line, to compose a 3D image of the topography of the surface. And due to the very high sharpness of the tip, the resolution can be very high. You have to imagine that there's a few atoms at the end of your tip, and this interacts with the surface, and this interaction is measured because the tip is mounted at the end of a cantilever, and this cantilever is bending relative to the surface topography. And this signal is recorded point by point, and in this manner we can reconstruct the 3D image of the surface.
So I guess you're using the AFM really for... Not for scanning across an entire field like humans would with their eyes, I guess, but for looking at very, very small samples.
Exactly. Yeah, the scan field of an atomic force microscope is about maybe 20 micrometers to be able to, with 256 pixels per line, to look at features down to maybe 10, 20 nanometers.
So what kind of features are you looking at? I guess you're analyzing dust particles. What can you find out with an atomic force microscope that you can't with an optical microscope or with whatever other techniques?
Okay. So first let me say that AFM is not usually used to measure dust particles because they're very loose on the surface. And usually atomic force microscopy is used to scan very flat surfaces and not... really apparent 3D structures like dust particles. It was a compromise to fly this AFM to Mars because it has this very high spatial resolution, which optical microscopes don't have, and it's not that complicated of an instrument compared to scanning electron microscopes, for example. So it was really a compromise why we got selected for this mission. Now, we would like to analyze dust particles to look at their size, obviously, at their size distribution, so how many particles are in what mass fraction, in what size exactly, and then there is the shape of the particles is very important to see if it's round or platy or if it has angles. So that were the basic primary goals of the atomic force microscope.
So tell us maybe, I mean, we have a lot of atomic force microscopes on Earth. What is so special and challenging in designing a sensor that has to operate on another planet?
So it was very challenging for different points, for different reasons. First of all, the temperature on Mars is quite low. It varies from minus 120 degrees down to about 0 degrees. And designing an instrument that is capable of performing at these temperatures is already the first challenge. Then we have the whole autonomy thing, meaning that when we have an instrument on Mars, we don't have direct contact with it. We have between 20 and 30 minutes of delay of the command that we send to Mars and the time it arrives on Mars and the instrument performs its executes this command. So the instrument has to be quite smart and perform measurements in an autonomous way. So people who know a little bit about AFM know that it's quite complicated measurement where you have to twiddle the knobs and really look at different parameters to get a good image. So this was one of the big challenges, to make the instrument smart enough and autonomous enough to record images by itself. And then there was also the shock resistance, which for an instrument that is that sensitive with that high resolution, you can imagine that there are quite sensitive parts on it. And during launch phase and cruise phase, there are always these pyrotechnical separation stages where you separate the stages by pyrotechnical explosions. And you have quite high accelerations during these separations, and the instrument has to survive that. So there was another one. Then we have radiation on Mars. On the surface of Earth, we are protected by the cosmic radiations, by the electromagnetic field of the Earth. And on Mars, that's not the case. So Mars is basically bombarded with heavy ions coming from outer space in a very high flux. And the instrument has to be protected against those heavy ion impacts. And most important is the protection of the electronics, meaning that we have single event upsets or single event latch up events, which will either alter the data that is stored or create shortcuts in the electrical circuitry. And most of that has to be protected.
Okay. Run us through maybe a typical task for the AFM then. Let's say that we have the AFM on Mars right now on the Phoenix, and we want to take a sample of something. As you said, there's a lot of intelligence and autonomy in this sensor. So I'm assuming, I guess you will send a command like pick up this dust particle and scan it. What will the AFM then go through?
Yeah, exactly. It's a whole sequence of things. First of all, well, as you mentioned, the whole sample delivery, which demands a robotic arm to pick up the dust and to deliver it on top of our scientific instrument, which is MECA. Then we have other robotic conveyors that convey the soil sample in front of the microscope. And one of the critical parts is the approach. You can imagine that such a small tip, very sharp tip, has to be treated very carefully. And the approach of the dust particles to that tip is one of the major issue where we need to be very careful not to crash the tip or not to harm the tip or even break a cantilever. So there is this approach mechanism. Then the image is taken with predefined parameters that are sent from Earth. And this image is simply stored on the lander in this sent back to Earth at the end of the day. So we don't know before the end of the day what really the instrument could perform. And there is no really a feedback mechanism or an analysis of this image and then an improvement of this image. So what we send on Mars is basically a set of predefined parameters that the microscope will use to perform its images.
Do you have any way to alter these parameters once you've taken one image and analyzed it?
Definitely, yeah.
Okay,
this is done on Earth, and after a subsequent imaging, we will probably... What has been probably done is the change of the parameters to get a better image.
Okay, so this sensor, as you mentioned, landed on Mars last summer. And I guess the Phoenix finished its mission and is no longer active. So the sensor is no longer active. But during the several months of it being used, what can you already tell us what has been discovered? What kind of images were taken and what kind of results have come out of it?
So again, I'm taking a step back and I want to reframe what the AFM was really, what type of instrument it was. From the start on, it was a high-risk instrument with low priority in the whole execution scheme of the mission. And for that, we were already happy to first show that the instrument works, that we can perform AFM measurements on Mars. So first we took, for example, calibration images, which have no scientific throughput, really. There's no information from Mars coming from that, but it simply shows that atomic force microscopy in another planet was possible. So it was already a very high result for us and very satisfying result. And then we could produce about 80 images of dust particles themselves, and they're now analyzed, and there's really some discussion happening on what we see on that, looking at dust particle distribution, looking at the size of these particles, and that is even more satisfactory for us, that AFM imaging and the AFM images contribute to the whole picture of these of the dusts on Mars. And yet we don't really have big conclusions at the moment. There is a lot of discussions on the results and what has happened in the past of the planet's history compared to what we see now with these particles. But for now, the scientific community is really arguing and discussing things rather than taking conclusion out of it. So we're now 1 year after the mission, and the results are still analyzed. There's still some publications, scientific publications on the way, which will analyze in more detail what is happening with these measurements.
I guess that's what happens with data that comes back from another planet. I've heard this about other probes as well, is that you know, the mission might be 3 months, but it takes a few years afterwards for all this data to be properly analyzed and properly looked through and discussed.
Exactly. And all these data contributes to having a whole picture of what we see and what we measure. For example, the Viking mission of 72, there's some data that is reanalyzed every time a new mission is sent to Mars to compare it. And this is very satisfactory for our AFM measurements, that they will contribute now to this discussion.
So let's look a bit towards the future. Now that you have sent an AFM to Mars and proven that it works and that we can do this kind of high precision measurements on another planet, what's the next step? What's the next thing the next challenge that you see in designing sensors for being sent on such missions?
Well, this AFM showed also that the MEMS technology has a future in space exploration, because it was really one of the first instruments that comprised a MEMS device, a microelectromechanical system out of silicon. And there is also always these big talks about MEMS in space and nanosatellites, picosatellites using MEMS devices. And it is like a precursor of what will happen in the next maybe 100 years, that we try to make things smaller and to make them more often, and not just one mission every 2 years or one big satellite sent to space every 2 or 3 years, but really send myriads of satellites in space, all of them having the same functionality and being very small and very lightweight, so that we can reduce the launch costs of that. So that's the really futuristic vision of space exploration, is that MEMS will be a big part of that.
Can you give us maybe a thought on the SwissCube? I'm not sure if you heard of this. It's a satellite that's, I think, 10 centimeters cubed on each side, and it's really tiny, yet it was just launched into space, probably for not a very high cost because of its small size and weight, yet it can still produce some valid scientific results. I guess this is what you're talking about.
Exactly, yeah. That's also one of these precursor missions where really we demonstrate the technology, and hopefully it will work really fine. And making things smaller and making them more often sent to space will help to go in that direction, making things even smaller and more robust, and also having more of them, not just one satellite, but then having thousands of them communicating between each other. And it's hard to go in the space business and to make science, because the really hard space business is not related really to science, but has really earthbound applications. And there is two ways to implement slowly MEMS into this whole field. One is to really go the what I would call the top-down philosophy, is to incorporate MEMS devices into existing satellites and bigger satellites. And the other way is the bottom-up approach, where we really try to make everything MEMS and send it to space and then look how it performs and improve it that way. And hopefully both philosophies will meet at a point where we'll have a lot of satellites based all of probably a big composition of it made of MEMS.
Maybe as just a last question, what you're talking about sending thousands of satellites into space, what about space junk? Will that not slowly become a problem if we've got all these small, really fast-moving objects flying around in space?
Not really, because they have a short lifetime. From my knowledge, if they're small, they will have the tendency to go back to Earth more quickly. And as they're small, they will all disintegrate in the atmosphere. So they have maybe a lifetime of 2 to 4 years, which will also push for evolved technology, because it has to be renewed every time. Big satellites are up there for tens of years. Some of them are already 30 years old, and they really contribute to space junk, because they, if they're not forced to come back to Earth, they will stay there forever. But smaller and pico nano satellites have a tendency to have a less long lifetime and then be renewed more often also.
Okay, great. Sebastian, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And hope to see some of your work in the future.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of Robots. Don't forget to tell us what you think about robots in our survey, which you can find on our website at www.robotspodcast.com/survey.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Explore Space with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.